Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. I'm here in the kitchen at KHOI Community Radio. This fine radio station gives a good home to the Donalana Kitchen. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, opinions, and today we're going to be talking about the holidays. Support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op. Happy holidays. Today on the Donalana Kitchen, we will explore the tastes of the season. I had a good time over the past few weeks talking to people about their holiday taste memories. We all have them. Pine cones, candy canes, the taste of snowflakes on your tongue, the smell of Christmas baking. And we'll hear some fine holiday carols, some of them real golden oldies. The tradition of the wassail bowl, sharing the common bowl of warmed spice spirits, has been going on for a long, long time. Friends and neighbors gathering on a cold winter night to eat, drink, sing, and celebrate. There are many songs about the Christmas wassail. Mostly they've come from the European tradition, but here is a version that's made its way to America, the Kentucky wassail. Was the Kentucky Wassail by Kathy Barton, Dave Parra, and the Peyton Family Band. We're going to explore some holiday taste memories now. I asked Donna Prisgintis to tell me about her favorite holiday taste traditions. Holidays have a certain taste to them. Donna, what does the holiday taste like for you? What is the thing that it wouldn't be the holiday without?
Well, my favorite thing, actually we like to do this on the solstice, on the 21st, is to whatever we're doing and however we're celebrating on that night, we turn out all the lights in the house and everything's lit with kerosene lamps and candles, because that's the longest night of the year with the least light. And it's also the return of the light coming back again. So on that evening, or on Christmas Eve, or both, the kind of family tradition, because my son's father is from Brittany in France, which is a large amount of seafood around there, really, really good seafood. We recreate it here because we have good seafood that's flown in, usually from the coast. So we like to open oysters and have oysters and champagne. So I order, and this takes a little pre-planning, but there is a really good, we're starting to get great oysters on both coasts here. There's a company in, I think it's Connecticut, called Island Creek Oysters that will overnight the oysters right to your front porch. And it's a good time of year to ship because it's cold. And also the oysters traditionally in the months that have R in them, which would be November and October, mostly in the winter months, the oysters are supposed to be less milky and taste better. So that's sort of the beginning of our holiday is oysters and champagne. The other thing, then, this happens on Christmas Day, is my grandmother's pudding, plum pudding recipe. So that is on our Donna Lana archive recipes as Grandma Baumgartner's plum pudding, and I make that for Christmas Day.
What do the holidays taste like for you?
My family had a big tradition of making or having Tom and Jerry batter, and it reminds me of that. It's a great drink that you add libations to, and that particular drink is what reminds me of the holidays because it's one of the earliest memories I have of my family together.
Thank you, Cynthia McClure.
I'm Barb Morris, and to me, the holidays taste like lefse.
I'm Michael Morris, and as long as there's pie involved, that I consider that a holiday.
My name is Allison Canaley, and I own Alley Cakes. And I would say that the holidays taste like nostalgia to me. When I think of baking holiday things, I always think of being in the kitchen with my family and my mom, so I think of holidays are nostalgic.
My name is Elise Fazio, and the holidays to me taste like snowflake cookies coming straight from Alley Cakes Bakery.
This is Alan Gildahouse, but everybody, you all know me as Gildy. What the holidays taste like for me is when I was a young man and we would spend Christmas on Cape Cod with my grandparents. We lived in Concord, but every once in a while we would go up to Cape Cod to my grandparents' house. My grandmother, who we called Mamie, made this dish, and it seems weird, but remember, we're New Englanders and we love seafood. One of the side dishes that she would make is something called grouper fingers. And grouper fingers is basically a glorified chicken finger only made with shredded grouper meat and breadcrumbs and garlic and, oh, just the oregano and just the best stuff in the world. And when I think of holidays, that's one of the numerous dishes that I think of. But it was probably my favorite, I think, because grouper is just awesome. If you're a deep sea fish kind of person, grouper is awesome, and it's much cheaper than swordfish.
I'm here with Sue DeBleek, and I have a question to ask her. What do the holidays taste like for you, Sue?
I would say the holidays taste like cinnamon and nuts and beer and also chocolate.
And which ones are your favorite?
I'd say a combination of all of those is my favorite. Cookies with chocolate and with nuts on them and cinnamon and with a little side of beer.
This next holiday taste memory comes from Georgia. Not the Georgia that sits between the states of Alabama and South Carolina, but the Georgia that sits between the Black and the Caspian Sea. This is the story of sweets made for the new year.
Okay, my name is Georgi Chikladze, and this food is from Georgia. It's not very usual to have it for New Year. I mean, almost it's very exclusive for New Year. And the name is Gozinaki. So it's honey and walnut. It is cooked slowly together. It's on the very low fire, and then it's let to cool down for a while, and you're making a little kind of slim layer, like some panel, and you are like cutting it into the pieces, and you are going and distributing among your friends and neighbors particularly, and you're also getting the ones from your neighbors, and it's really important part. And when you are giving the, oh, I forgot to say this. So when you are giving this one, so you are wishing your neighbor or whoever you give it to have as sweet year as this Gozinaki, as this dish is. So it's really important. So it's associated with the year. That's why you have to like give the sweet one, so you wish them to have a sweet year too.
Carol Horowitz, what do the holidays taste like for you?
To me, the Jewish holidays, me, I like, I mean, there are a lot of wonderful holidays that I celebrate. I mean, 4th of July is fun. But, okay, what does the holidays mean to me? It's tradition. It's meaningful, and it reminds us of who we are. And it's tasty and delicious.
My name is Ruth Burke, and the holidays taste like a lot of things. So there's always the classic cinnamon or vanilla, the cookies, the sugar cookies, the pumpkin pie, that kind of stuff. But the holidays also taste like, well, a really good stout or a good porter, really rich and chocolatey. And that's something we drink a lot in my family. So whenever I taste a stout or a porter, I'm instantly transported to Christmas. And of course, whiskey. You know, a little bit of whiskey in the Christmas morning tea helps you open gifts more rapidly, as my family likes to say. So, oh gosh, it makes it sound like alcohol figures prominently in my holiday celebrations, doesn't it? I bake a lot of pies, so mincemeat is one of my favorite smells. And, oh no, another alcohol reference here. I like to add rum or brandy to my mincemeat. I always think of mincemeat. And then, of course, I always think of the holidays. Lots and lots of spices for baking.
My name is Todd Michael, and I grew up in Ames, and I can't separate taste from smell. So my entire olfactory, gustatory, thalamico-pituito-adrenal axis goes crazy. And the entire thing is evoked by the scent, smelt of pine needles. I believe I ate them when I was a small child along with the potpourri, a potpourri. I used to say potpourri. Is that still allowable? All right. Well, that's what a taste smells like to me.
My name's Ursula Rudenberg, and the holidays smell like pine needles, but they taste like cookies. And it's two cookies in particular. One is a chocolate cookie, which is really, really rich, and the cookie is in the shape of either a spade or a clove or a heart, you know, like from playing cards. And the cookie is really dark brown, dark, dark, dark brown. And it has kind of a slightly thin crust on it that sometimes has powdered sugar sprinkled on it. And when you bite into it, the really thin crust gives way to a really soft, luscious interior. And it's a really, really rich flavor. It's not super sweet like fudge. It's semi-sweet, and it has a real strong cocoa taste. So it's not like a super sweet chocolate. It's more like the cocoa-y, just really deep, deep taste. And that is a Swiss recipe, which I've never seen anywhere else. And it's really too bad because it's just an incredibly good cookie. And I guess the fact that you don't get anywhere else makes it also very special. And I would love to get the recipe for it. My mother made it. My mother was Swiss. The other taste is also a Swiss cookie. And this one is a more well-known cookie. It's an anise cookie. And it tended to come in rectangles. And the rectangle has a design on top of it that comes from a mold that is usually very intricate. It's usually the face of a famous saint or, you know, some intricate person or design. Sometimes it has a Christmas tree on top of it. And the cookie is white. And it also has a slightly crusty surface. And again, when you bite into it, it gives way to this really, really soft interior, which is white. And the distinctive taste of the cookie has to do with the fact there's anise seeds in it. And so it has this incredibly, pungent isn't the right word, but just very distinctive, kind of bright, aromatic is the right word, aromatic essence of anise, which just makes it a very, again, it's not a super sweet cookie, but that anise taste, it's almost like licorice, just really gives it a real sparkle and just makes it real delightful. So with both of them, it's partly the texture and partly this kind of really bright taste both of them have. Really, it seems to me like old-fashioned recipes often have really intense taste, maybe less sweet than what we have today, but more distinctively intense. Less of the sugar and more of some other flavor to give it its personality. And that's what makes these cookies so special. And the chocolate cookie ages really well. It doesn't get hard. It stays really soft in the middle. And the anise cookies do get hard over time. So they're still good, but they get that wonderful, they're great for dipping into coffee. It definitely is a coffee cookie. But I have to say the chocolate cookies, part of the reason why they don't get dry over time is because they never last more than a day or two. Those are always the cookies in the bowl or in the basket that are absolutely gone first. Everybody just like makes a beeline for those because you can tell by looking at it that this is going to be a really good cookie, and it really is. So that's how Christmas tastes to me. And I also have to say, we always, always, always had candles on our Christmas trees, and that's part of the reason why it smells like pine needles to me, because the candles had a way of bringing out the smell of the pine tree. And not because it was burning the pine tree. Actually, candles are in some way safer than lights because you never leave a tree alone with candles. You're always watching it. And the truth is, unless your tree's very, very dry, it doesn't burn that easily. So it smells like pine needles, and it looks like this beautiful tree that's surrounded with this halo of candle glow, which is just it's worth seeing at least one time in your life.
I'm Paul Nelson, and the holidays this year have so far tasted to me like a freshly slaughtered Amish goose, correctly roasted, golden brown, with goose gravy and mashed potatoes, and let's see, there was fresh cranberry sauce, and oddly, muffuletta, olive salad, Cajun olive salad. Boy, was that good.
You're listening to KHOI FM 89.1. This is Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Holiday Radio for the heart of Iowa.
That's certain, and when those blue
We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking about holiday taste memories. I'm here in the studio with engineer Rick Morrison. So, Rick, what does a holiday taste like for you?
We know with the holidays, I really appreciate the homemade cooking, and that in itself is priceless, spending time with family and eating, you know, pretty much a traditional dish, you know, that you typically would have on that, you know, on Christmas, you know, cranberry sauce, stuffing, turkey, whatever. So, and yams, and, you know, so it's pretty much the sum of that is I enjoy the homemade cooking pretty much. That is definitely a special treat to me, and it's a, you know, labor of love that goes into that food, and you can definitely taste it. So,
good. Thanks, Rick. My holiday tastes like cookies. Many kinds. I love making cookies, but I've always loved the taste of pfeffernuss. It's a firm little pepper and spice cookie that's just the right size to dunk into coffee. And I also think of the taste of nuts. A bowl of nuts on the table with a nutcracker and nut picks to keep you busy for as long as you care to eat them. As a child, my brother and I were always part of the Lutheran Church Christmas Eve service, full of much singing, reciting of Bible verses, and stiff white choir capes. I don't think this is true, but I was led to believe early on that a stellar performance at the church program was a prerequisite to a bountiful visit from Santa. The time in church on Christmas Eve gave the jolly old man a chance for him to slip it in and out of the house. We didn't have a fireplace. After the program, all of us kids would troop down to the church basement in an orderly Lutheran rows and find our coats and our parents, and as we went out the door, a line of men would greet us, the church elders, most of them good Wisconsin dairy farmers, still sporting the farmer tan, sun-brown faces with their pale white foreheads from the hats they wore all year. And these men would give us all a sack of nuts, fruit, and usually a real live candy bar. We looked forward to that. We didn't have to share that candy bar with anybody. Ah, the taste of Christmas. Speaking of nuts, I'd like to share some thoughts about nuts. This is a reading a couple paragraphs taken from a book called The Global Forest by Diana Burford Kroger. Thanks to Mark Edwards for sharing this book and this fine author with me. Diana Burford Kroger writes eloquently about trees, forests, and biodiversity. This is from a chapter in her book, The Global Forest, and the chapter is called A Handful of Nuts. There are nuts to die for in North America. They've been part of the native wildwood forest for a long time. In the hungry past, nut trees were known to the native peoples as anti-famine trees. This was because famine stalked this continent in climatic cycles. The edible landscape kept the people alive through the bad times of collective hunger. Nuts come in all shapes and sizes, and many plant families produce them. These families have representatives all across the world. The nuts of related families are similar in shape but rarely identical in taste because of variation in local soils, which changes the tree's biochemistry. A nut is a fruit. It's most often single-seeded. The seed is protected by a pericarp coat. This, in turn, is usually protected by a husk. As the nut matures, the husk may open, but the pericarp coat never does. The seal is forever, except when acted on by the enzymes of germination. The delicate embryo inside is protected by the strength of the pericarp wall. If the embryonic center dries down a little, the space formed is a trigger for the germination within the nut. The force in germination and subsequent growth are powerful enough to rend apart the two fragments. The physics of this natural act are extraordinarily powerful. The vast stands of American chestnuts of the beech family are still the most famous of North American trees. The tragedy of a blight, a canker-forming bark disease first discovered in New York City in 1904, added to their legend. The dark, shiny nuts encased by a hedgehog husk were once of the special treats of the continent. They could be eaten fresh or exploded into flour by heat. Chestnut is making a comeback. Time has favored the genetic code with resistance. The tree is relearning the lessons of life. It will be on the stage of our kitchens again soon. Smaller, sweeter nuts of the North American West are found in pine trees. The pine nuts of the western digger pine, the single-leaf pinyon pine, and the two-leaf pinyon pine. The favorite and most delectable nuts in North America are the buttered-flavored pecans. These large nuts have a very extensive market. A close second are the shagbarks and the king nuts. Their popularity is rising. Nuts of the walnut family are enjoying a resurgence. These are the black walnuts and the butternuts. The meats of these walnuts are unique. They can undergo the process of industrial food manufacture in various popular foods without a change in flavor. Black walnut ice cream is an example. Then when the nut meats are extracted, the wood-like pericarp shells are used in the pressure washing of the facades of older buildings and the sandblasting of paint on aircraft. Historically, probably the most important nut to the native peoples for everyday use was the bur oak. This large-seeded oak produced a yearly crop of very edible sweet nuts. The flavor of these nuts varies from location to location, the sweeter being found in karst or limestone areas. These bur oak acorns were collected in great numbers. These acorn nuts were eaten as vegetables. They were cooked over an open fire, and the pericarp peeled. The meat was also dried and ground into flour. A bannock, a kind of sweet scone, was baked in with the flour. It was said to have the flavor of mild peanuts and a rich rose color. These were cooked without salt. Table salt or sodium chloride was not common on this continent. Wild herbs were used instead to enhance the flavors of food. Times have changed. Chestnuts are making a comeback, even here in Iowa. I've been enjoying roasting and eating chestnuts. I got them through the Farm to Folk CSA from a place called Burning Sky Farm in New Virginia, Iowa. They have a Facebook, Burning Sky Farm at Facebook.com. Another holiday flavor that I haven't tasted in quite a while is mincemeat. I asked my friend Ruth Burke about that. What is in mincemeat pie?
Oh my gosh, the better question is what isn't in mincemeat pie? So if you'll allow me, I'll give you a little bit of a history about mincemeat. So back in the day, when meat was incredibly expensive and valuable, you didn't want to waste it. So as soon as meat started to go bad, families would gather it up, and they would boil the heck out of it until there was nothing alive in it that could hurt you. And then they would heavily, heavily spice it and mix it in with things like raisins or dates and a lot of spices, cinnamon, cloves, that kind of thing. And they would bake it into a pie. And that way you didn't taste that the meat was bad, and they didn't waste the meat, and it became a holiday tradition. And then slowly over time, fast forward several hundred years to nowadays, people don't put meat in it anymore. They just put things like raisins and dates and sometimes candied fruit peel, kind of like a fruit cake, but that tastes terrible. And they'll put cloves and cinnamon and often brandy or rum is put into it. When I make mincemeat now, I'll make it a little more traditionally, and I'll either make it with beef suet or venison. It tastes better with venison, in my humble opinion. But again, heavy on the sugar, heavy on the brandy or the rum, heavy on cinnamon and cloves and raisins and currants, if you can get those, and dates or figs. So it's a rich pie.
So you put meat in your mincemeat pie.
Yes, I definitely do. It's mincemeat, dang it, should have meat in it. lard or fat, obviously suet. I mean, if you use suet, then that's your fat, but it tastes wonderful. It's very, very hearty, but it's also sweet, kind of sweet and savory. I like to eat it warm, fresh out of the oven, but you can eat it cold. It tastes it is the best Christmas morning.
With bays and rosemary, and I pray may my masters be merry, for this deceit convivio, capo da pride ferro, redens laris domino. The boar's head, as I understand, is the rarest dish in all the land, which thus bedecked with a gay galand and a celere cantico, capo da pride ferro, redens laris domino. A steward hath provided this in honor of the king of bliss, which on this day to be served is in bed.
That was the Boar's Head Carol. I mentioned earlier that we were going to do some golden oldies, and that's probably the goldenest and oldenest Christmas carol that I know. It's called the Boar's Head Carol. The original was the Boar's Head with Mustard. That was the original name of the thing. And it's one of those carols that is very, very traditional, and it really has nothing to do with Jesus in the manger or angels or anything. It's celebrating a feast, although we do thank the Lord for the feast and all that sort of thing. So this old English carol is the earliest known example of the printed carol. So it could have been sung long before that. It was found in a collection called Wynkyn de Worde, printed in 1521, less than 50 years after the printing press had been introduced to England. The legend is great. The carol is based on a legend that a student of Queen's College was attacked by a wild boar while studying his Aristotle. Having no other means of defense, he jammed the volume of Aristotle down the boar's throat and thus saved himself. Since then, the boar's head has always been served at Queen's College, Oxford, on Christmas Day. And yes, Queen's College, and actually a lot of other old world men's colleges and other Ivy League sort of places celebrate this sort of thing. You may actually hear this song sung at the Madrigal Dinner, which I hear is, it's that sort of carol. It's a processional. It's bringing in the food. The serving of the boar's head is an old Yuletide custom of Scandinavian origin. It was the first dish of a Yule celebration and was always served with a song. The boar's head is brought in, a soloist chants the verses of the boar's head carol, and the students all join in the chorus. The chorus is always sung in Latin, and I've been singing this for years. I didn't really know what the Latin meant. I thought it just kind of meant eat, drink, be merry, or don't worry, be happy, something like that, which is a good thing to sing when you have your boar's head and your cups of ale. But the chorus translates to, I offer this boar head and give praises to the Lord, which I suppose is more Queen's College-like. And it's most interesting that this started in the 12th century, this Yule custom of serving a boar's head, and it is still observed. So you can find people still doing this sort of thing. You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen. That was a bit about the tradition of the boar's head carol. Music. was the Christmas hornpipe and the bottom of the punch bowl. Nice dance tunes there, played by Al and Alita Murphy. I learned last week on the Donna Lana Kitchen, on this very program, that the holiday classic libation Tom and Jerry was invented in America in the year 1821 by an author named Pierce Egan to publicize his book and his stage play called Tom and Jerry or Life in London. It was maybe one of the first commercial product placement media tie-ins in history. It was a big hit, evidently. People enjoyed something warm and frothy and tasty in the middle of the winter. A Tom and Jerry is a frothy milk, egg, sugar, and spice batter warmed with boiling water. And, of course, adding your favorite rum, cognac, or other favorite holiday tipple. Donna has been away for a couple weeks, and it's still away. She's in New Zealand for the holidays, but she's been sending some important bits of news and recipes. And she sent a Tom and Jerry sort of recipe here, all the way from New Zealand. And it's called a Tom and Ginger. So it's not really a Tom and Jerry. It's Tom and Jerry with a whole lot of ginger added. Like a Tom and Jerry recipe, it has a egg and sugar batter. And this one has cinnamon, nutmeg, cloves, allspice, adds bitters, and lots of ground ginger, vanilla extract, and rum. And that's for the batter. Okay? And then for the cocktail, add whatever other good stuff you'd like, a bit more stuff, and then more ginger. So that's a Tom and Ginger. You can find this recipe, which is kind of long and complicated here, but I think it might be worth attempting for the holidays, from a website called Tasting Table, www.tastingtable.com. The recipe is called Nog and Smile - Tom and Ginger Cocktail. Ooh, that sounds pretty good. So Tom and Jerry is about a play that was made in 1821. It is not about Tom and Jerry the cartoon. No, so I learn something every day on this show. There's lots of good things to eat this time of year. Let's listen to this bit of Christmas past from a past Donna Lana Kitchen show. Donna talks about trifle. You wanted to talk about trifles. Trifle's a Christmassy thing. What is a trifle?
A trifle is, it's not a trifle to make it, I'll tell you. It's pudding, cake. You bake the cake or lady fingers, and then you make a pudding, usually vanilla, and you have whipped cream, and then you have various fruits. And you have these bowls, of course, that are clear glass so you can see it, and you start layering. You put the cake on the bottom, then you put a big layer of pudding over it. Then you put in some fruits, and this year I had the pleasure of Helen Gunderson's gooseberries, they were just like little jewels. They're so pretty, kind of rosy and white. And so I just gave them a kind of a quick simmer in sugar, so they were slightly cooked, and then I chilled them. And so then I put in a layer of gooseberries and then some whipped cream, and then I made a gelée out of some black currants that I had merely I think I just cooked them down and ran them through the moulin and then froze them up. So it was just pure black currant puree. So I added some sugar to that and some what's the blackberry cordial? I'm just forgetting.
Cassis.
Yeah, so I had the actual blackberries, black currants, yeah. Sorry.
But the black currants.
The black currants, and then the cassis and sugar. And then I added gelatin. So when I put that in the fridge, it set it up so I was able to drop little jewels of black currant into it. So I've got cake, pudding, whipped cream, some fruit, which was gooseberries and black currant gelée. Just kind of keep, and you do a layer of each one, and then a second layer of each one, and then you serve it forth. in all its gloppy glory.
It actually sounds way too pretty to eat, but once you realize what's in there, you want to get your spoon way down to the bottom to get all of that stuff. What rifle with the gelée, the globules of jelly bits in it, and that really added a lot. Because it's all about texture and nice, gushy, wonderful things.
Well, and it's also I was very proud of this one because I didn't, you know, resort to buying out-of-season strawberries or out-of-season raspberries, which, you know, typically people do, because you want some fruity bits in there. So by having the bright notes of Helen's gooseberries and then the deeper notes of the black currants, it was just, you know, it cut through the sweetness of the pudding and the whipped cream and the cake.
And the cake. It was good. And this was by candlelight. Candlelight, yes. That's a nice thing to do in the darkest days of the year. This is the Abbott's Bromley Horn Tune. And it goes with the Abbott's Bromley Horn Dance, a very old, old tradition that still is being done. That's the Abbott's Bromley Horn Dance tune, made to go with the Abbott's Bromley Horn Dance.
Horn dance.
Okay. I mentioned that because, like the tune before, which was probably the oldest written down Christmas carol that we've found so far, this has been an object of discussion and study by historians for a long time, because in the village of Abbott's Bromley in Staffordshire, England, there was a set of reindeer horns found that were, along with some ritual sort of things like bells and a hobby horse, which is a little wooden puppet, part of the mummers tradition, part of the Morris dance tradition. Very old pre-Christian stuff happening here, back when England had a lot of other things going on besides just the Christian Christmas. But by now, this dance is often performed for Christmas, more often performed for New Year's Day, but originally was always danced at the beginning or a few weeks before the fall equinox. It has horns connected to it, reindeer horns. It was believed to be a hunting sort of ritual. Again, we're talking about possible food for the winter here. Always danced by a troop of men doing a very staid sort of procession again. Very, very old tune, very, very old dance. Probably, they've kind of put this all together, they've dated the reindeer horns that they found to the 11th century. And that is actually kind of strange because reindeer were probably extinct in England at that time, but you could always call away to the Scandinavian countries, I suppose.
when the last Boers were supposedly
seen
in England.
Heaven knows. But evidently the reindeer horns were really important. And it's speculated that this dance originated during the pagan period having to do with the extensive hunting lands of the Needwood Forest and the Cannock Chase Forest surrounding the village of Abbots Bromley. The dance to that very, very old tune would be danced by the guys with the reindeer horns, and then along with some other sort of characters, you'd see a fool, the man-woman, which is also a traditional mummer's sort of thing, a hobby horse, and a hunter, a boy hunter with bows and arrows would come out, and it would be to bring luck, to gather money for the poor, all that sort of thing. And I had the great good fortune of actually seeing this done at a New Year's Eve festival in Berea, Kentucky a couple years ago. And if the lights go all down, everything is lit by candles, and there is a bonfire out in the courtyard, and this haunting music starts. It's very, very simple, very, very simple. Originally, it was just done with pipes or fifes, or later a violin, and now you can throw in an accordion if you want. But it's a very, very simple tune, and to see some very large men with very large horns on their heads coming out of the mist, it's actually a very lovely thing. So it's invoking the spirit of the woods, the spirit of the hunt, and bringing good luck for the new year. So that's another one of our golden oldies, Abbots Bromley Horn Dance. We're back. Hope you all are enjoying a happy holiday and are enjoying many good tastes. As we think of one year ending and the other year beginning, perhaps it's time to think a little bit about New Year's resolutions. Think about this one. How about some peace on earth for a change? I noticed on the cover of our fine local publication, The Tunes, put out by Rick Lem. He always includes a nice quote or two, and there's a quote on the cover this week by Arundhati Roy, the author and an activist from India. She says, "Once weapons were manufactured to fight wars, now wars are manufactured to sell weapons." So let's think of better things for the new year. Let's work on some peace on earth for a change. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. You've heard voices from your local community sharing some of their holiday taste memories, all those good holiday taste memories. What do the holidays taste like for you? And Christmas carols, we've heard some good old ones and some newer ones, too. We heard the Kentucky Wassail by Kathy Barton and Dave Parra, and a couple of golden oldies, the Boarhead's Carol and Abbott's Bromley Horn Dance. And we've had music by Al and Alita Murphy. We've heard the Blue Christmas Hornpipe. And we'll go out with more of Al and Alita Murphy with Silver Bells and Jingle Bells. Ho, ho, ho from the Donalana Kitchen. My name's Lana Noctigal. We've had excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. You can hear the Donalana Kitchen every Tuesday at noon. Repeated Tuesday at 7 p.m. on this fine station, KHOI. Or listen anytime. Go to khoifm.org. Stream. Download podcast. Tell your friends. We're always there on the web for you to listen to at your leisure. Thanks for your support. Thanks for listening. Have a tasty, tasty holiday. Eat good food and enjoy life.